Thank you. Be seated. The court is ready to hear oral argument from petitioner in Boyles v. Kerr.
May it please the court, the petitioner will be represented by Mr. Barry Chasnoff. Chasnoff is here 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you. I'm here today with Professor David Crump, Lynn Liberato, and Stephen Rogers, who are my co-counsel representing the petitioner Van Boyles in this case. The facts in this case, to the extent of relevance to these proceedings, can be very briefly stated. Mr. Boyles made a videotape of a sexual encounter between himself and Ms. Kerr. Mr. Boyles showed it on 3 occasions to a total of 10 people. A lawsuit was brought, initially pleading intentional infliction of emotional distress, negligent infliction of emotional distress, and invasion of privacy, which to date has been an intentional tort in this state. At trial, at the charge conference, the 2 intentional torts were dropped so that the only issue that went to the jury was the negligent infliction of emotional distress. We set forth in our brief the reasons that we believe this was done. We think it's pretty clear it's been done in a number of different situations in the state where the intentional torts are dropped, and that is to attempt to get to whatever insurance policy may be available in a particular case. The theory put forth on negligent infliction of emotional distress is that Texans owe one another a general duty to exercise care, not to injure the mental well-being of their fellow citizens. We refer in our brief to the tort as being an independent tort because it would be actionable whether or not there was a breach of a separate tort duty or a contract duty. We also talked about it as a general purpose tort because it would be unlimited in the variety of situations where it could be applied. One thing I want to point out is that whether recovery might be available in a case such as this is not really the issue. Ms. Kerr could have sought recovery under her intentional torts. And the emotional distress for which she recovered, it would have been an appropriate element of damages for those intentional torts. The intentional infliction of emotional distress, and even more clearly, the invasion of privacy. This court in the Billings v. Atkinson case said that it was an intrusion into private affairs when someone secretly tape-recorded a conversation. Here we had a videotaping of an incident. The concern, therefore, expressed by the amicus brief filed in this case by the Texas Women's Political Caucus, the concern about the invasion of women's privacy rights, that concern can be addressed with existing causes of action. That is, for the intrusion into private affairs. Further, the statements made by the Court of Appeals and by Ms. Kerr that they did not have a cause of action for an intentional tort because Mr. Boyles testified that he didn't intend the harm is also does also not work because the issue is whether the action was intentional, not whether the harm was intentional.
Counsel, let me understand that. Of course, he intended to take videos, no question about that.
That's right, Your Honor.
He intended to show them to his friends.
That's correct.
In fact, set up a series of showings. And you're saying that that is the only thing addressed. Unless he intended to harm her, that she has no cause of action.
No, I'm not saying that. I'm saying that going to be Atkinson cause of action. She does have a cause of action for the intentional tort of intrusion into privacy.
In other words, if he intended to take the tapes, he intended to show them to friends, and he did not intend to harm her,
that's correct.
She has no cause of action for any negligence at any point.
That's our position. For any negligence at any point.
Reckless disregard for the consequences. Obviously, showing them to the public, he's showing them to his friends. So I think you've got 10 people. It doesn't have to be generally published on a television set, but it's published to those people. The fact that they went out and talked about it circulated rumors on both campuses and a lot of gossip on both campuses. And she, I don't think anybody's questioning that she suffered some harm. If he didn't intend that to happen, then she has no cause of action. He didn't intend for them to go out and talk about it. His reckless disregard of the fact that human nature is such that those things would occur. And he just didn't have, you know, didn't care what they did with the information. She has no cause of action.
She does not have a cause of action for negligent infliction of emotional distress. She does have a cause of action for the invasion of privacy, and all the damages about which you have spoken would be recoverable if the jury saw fit under that cause of action. The only difference, the only reason the change was made was to get to the insurance policy, and the difficulty with that is...
If you intentionally do something, you're not liable for unintended consequences.
Oh, but you are.
If that's the cause of action.
If that's the cause of action, that's correct. Your intentional action is the cause of action.
What is the evidence here of any intent to inflict injury?
The evidence is of the intent to do the act of videotaping and of showing.
No, that's not in dispute.
That
he intended
correct.
To do that. They intended to show it. There's also some evidence about his intent to destroy the films at some point, wasn't there?
Well, he testified that he offered to destroy the films and that instead Ms. Kerr asked that they be given to her, and they were.
What evidence is there that he intended to cause her harm?
Well, without wanting to argue the other side, the fact is that there was evidence of some incidents in some restaurants where he encountered friends of hers, other evidence about what was done after these events, from which certainly an argument could have been made by able counsel that there was intention to do harm.
I was somewhat confused by the suggestion in your brief about something about putting a blanket over her at the last moment, suggesting he had second thoughts.
That portion of the videotape is covered, he indeed is covered by a blanket. They are.
Doesn't that suggest that perhaps the way he handled this involved carelessness rather than intentional wrongdoing?
The argument can be made in every intentional tort case that there's a lesser included tort of negligence. And certainly an argument can be made in this case that there was a negligence also involved.
Well, I guess the argument can always be made, but here from your brief, there's some evidence of it, isn't there?
There is evidence from which it could be argued, yes, sir.
And there was also evidence of negligence in failing to destroy the tape in as well, wasn't it?
That could also be argued.
So it is possible, indeed, it is your contention that you can always argue it, but it's possible that with any given course of conduct, there can be a mixture of negligence and intent.
Yes, and yes, Your Honor. And if the negligence aspects are separately breaches of separately represented, recognized duties, then there would be a negligence cause of action. The only cause of action which we dispute and which we argue that this court should not create is that separate independent cause of action for negligent infliction of emotional distress.
Well, the restatement of TART Section 46 recognizes such a cause of action if there is recklessness, does it not?
Yes, it does, under certain limited circumstances.
And under those certain limited circumstances, you reject not only the San Elizabeth Hospital case, but you reject our following the restatement, do you not?
Well, two parts to that question. First, as to St. Elizabeth's, we do not reject St. Elizabeth's. Our position is that St. Elizabeth was a case that involved a breach of a traditional contractual duty that
well, you indicate in your brief that every bit of St. Elizabeth can be characterized as dicta, that there's really no holding applicable.
No, Your Honor, the only portion of it that is not that is not dicta in our position is that which eliminates the physical manifestation requirement.
Right.
For emotional distress.
But your comment at note 7 of your brief was everything in Santa Elizabeth Hospital is dicta.
Well, more accurately, perhaps it should have been stated that everything other than that holding was dicta.
And then you proceed to criticize Santa Elizabeth Hospital as being a minority, really being a minority rule, and that even the minority is vanishing. Isn't that correct?
Well, we say St. Elizabeth does not reflect a movement to the state of Texas to that minority rule. And as far as that minority rule, it indeed is vanishing. That is, there have been 9 states, although we say in our brief 8, we have discovered a 9th, which have purported to recognize a general tort of negligent infliction of emotional distress. Of those 9, 5 have specifically moved away from it. In the other 4, 2 of them have put other limits on. There are only 2 states which have not yet fully grappled with the difficulties. I mean, the first state to come up with the broad negligent infliction of emotional distress tort was Hawaii in the Rodriguez case in 1970.
And those arguments are dealt with at great length in your brief. And so in effect, really, aren't you arguing for us, whether it's all dicta or not, to overrule and disapprove of the language in Santa Elizabeth Hospital, particularly that language which refers back to the last century in Texas' adoption of negligent infliction for emotional injury?
Your Honor, if I may answer that in 2 ways. First of all, we do not believe that litany of cases, Hill, Hader, and Kaufman, indeed do adopt negligent infliction. And secondly, we are not asking this court to do something which we believe it has already done. That is, in the Reagan v. Bond and the Freeman City of Pasadena, this court has already determined and stated, I believe, that St. Elizabeth does not create the general broad duty to avoid negligent infliction of emotional distress, because if that duty had been in existence under St. Elizabeth, then the results in those cases would have been the opposite in our view.
You disagree that Texas first recognized the tort of negligent infliction of mental anguish way back in Hill against Kimball?
Yes, Your Honor.
And so to the extent you disagree with it, you disagree with what this court wrote in St. Elizabeth Hospital, and you ask us to disapprove or overrule it, don't you?
If I'm answering 2 parts. First of all, as to Hill v. Kimball, it was a classic bystander case, and under the current rules of this court and Freeman, there simply wouldn't have been recovery by the plaintiff in that case. She was an unfortunate victim, but the court has said we're going to draw a right line, and under the Freeman case, since she was not a close relative, then she would not have recovered under current rules. And as far as St. Elizabeth, yes, we are saying that to the extent that St. Elizabeth states that there is an independent free-floating cause of action for negligent infliction of emotional distress, that this court should and has, in fact, in Reagan v. Vaughn and Freeman already said we are not going to apply it in that way.
All right, and as it relates to the bystander cases, then is it your position that if her father or her mother saw this tape that they could recover as bystanders, but she can't?
If the other requirements of the Dillon v. Lake test out of California adopted in Freeman were met by the viewing of this tape, that is, a sudden, unexpected occurrence which caused severe injury to a relative of theirs, then it could be argued that applied. We would say that, I mean, I think that under the circumstances of that happening, which I have not fully considered, that the injury they would not be viewing an injury contemporaneously happening to their child, but perhaps it could be argued otherwise. But if they met the Dillon v. Lake Freeman standards in those circumstances, they might be able to recover.
And then going back to my original question about the restatement of torts, the position that you're advocating today is in conflict with Section 46 on the portion of Section 46 that relates to recklessness.
To the extent it relates to recklessness, that's correct, and I am trying to recall that provision. I recall in our first brief we dealt with that section of the restatement, and we dealt with it in a more specific way, and I cannot recall that right now, but I will search my memory for that. I believe it is the requirement that there be a jury finding of outrageousness, which is, did not occur in this.
There was a finding of gross negligence here?
Yes.
Isn't that equivalent?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I don't believe that the findings in this case match even the restatement provision.
Counsel, can you address the reasons why the California Supreme Court in 1989 decided to reverse the recognition of this tort and expand on your brief in that regard?
I don't know that I can expand on my brief. I can perhaps state it in a more succinct way. Basically, what happened was they found out it was a disaster. They were getting all sorts of causes of action. The two quotes from that case that stick in my mind was that relying on pure foreseeability didn't work because foreseeability, like light in a vacuum, travels forever. They also made the comparison to casting a pebble into a pond. They were getting ever widening circles of liability. There were too many cases. There were too many. They tried this distinction between direct and not direct victims. It just didn't work. It simply didn't work. There were too many causes of action. They were far too remote. And even when the jury, what California found was even when the defendant was ultimately winning at the jury level, the defendant was being subjected to a cause of action that imposed great costs. When the question was asked in the last argument about what happens if a guard looks at a prisoner the wrong way and upsets them, that's not a cause of action. Well, putting aside the issue of the protections for that certain prison officials have, if you move that cause of action out on the streets and someone doesn't like the way that you look at them or doesn't like the way that you talk, you could file a cause of action for negligent infliction of emotional distress that would make it to the jury if you had any evidence that it caused you emotional distress. And then you have the battle of the psychiatrist that California also found to be a problem. Just like Hawaii when it came in with Rodriguez, which was a drainage case, negligent allowing of drainage, they said there is no limit on negligent infliction of emotional distress. But then what they found in 5 years later in the Kelly case, a man dropped dead of a heart attack in California when he found his daughter had been in an accident in Hawaii, and they said, well, that's too far away. It's led in what the courts of Hawaii have now done is the same island rule. So if the action happens on the same island, you can recover. And there was a case in Hawaii under this where someone's dog was negligently injured, was killed. They were allowed to file a lawsuit for negligent infliction of emotional distress over the loss of their dog. And the court ruled that since the dog was in Honolulu and they happened to be in Honolulu at the time, they could recover, but had they been on a different island, they couldn't have recovered. Bottom line on the entire negligent infliction tort, as the plaintiffs in this case would open it up, it's been the experience in state after state. There is no limit on it. It's limited only by the creativity of the plaintiff's lawyer's mind. There are remedies available for those torts which need a remedy.
Well, as far as California is concerned, tell me what there is in Marlene F. against Affiliated Psychiatric Medical Clinics that tells you that the plaintiffs couldn't maintain the same kind of action there that they have brought here in view of the California courts holding there that the negligent causing of emotional distress is not an independent tort, but it's just part of the general tort of negligence.
Well, in that case, exactly, Your Honor. In that case, the court, in light of Thing v. Lachusa, said we've got to look to the independent breach of a duty. And in that case, there was a psychiatrist who owed a duty to his patient. He was treating both the child who he physically and sexually abused and the mother. And the court found there was a duty to his patient the mother who brought the cause of action. And one of the elements of damages which they allow was for mental distress. They did not, however, allow the issue to be submitted as a separate cause of action for negligent infliction of emotional distress.
But she was permitted to bring an action for negligence against the doctor, though she was not a bystander and not the immediate object of the tortious conduct.
That's right, Your Honor, because the doctor had breached an independent duty owed by a doctor, especially a psychiatrist, to his patient and her psychic well-being.
I want to be sure I understand what you're saying. Are you saying that it's permissible to bring a cause of action for negligent infliction of emotional distress whenever that emotional distress is inflicted in association with some recognized intentional tort?
No, Your Honor. What I'm saying is that when the separate recognized tort is brought and a finding is made of liability on it, that one of the element of damages that is permissible is the emotional distress, which or emotional damage which was caused to the plaintiff by the breach of that other tort. And it is the existence of that separate tort or breach of contract.
But we create a wall. They cannot bring a cause of action. They cannot recover as an element of damages in negligent infliction of emotional distress unless they bring a cause of action for the intentionally inflicted tort. Is that what you're saying?
Well, either the intentionally inflicted tort or some other negligent tort. For example, an automobile
accident. They can't put in evidence that the intentional tort was committed and it had negligent consequences, and they want to recover for the negligent consequences. They have to pursue the intentional tort and a recovery for the intentional tort in order to get a recovery for the negligent consequences. Isn't that rather an artifice?
To a certain extent, it is an artifice, and what has happened throughout modern legal history is that the courts have looked for a way to draw a limit. Originally, no recovery was ever allowed for mental anguish because the courts were so concerned about it. And over time, it was allowed under certain circumstances where there was a physical manifestation. This court and some others have eliminated the physical manifestation requirement. They've also gone further in bystander cases and say, well, there, because there is no other possible recovery in a bystander case, and we know that the parent who sees his child killed in a car wreck, we know that there's mental injury there, we're going to allow it. But why has this court said no if the parent is around the corner and doesn't see the accident, they can't recover? Because this court, as well as other courts around this country, have said we've got to draw a bright, somewhat arbitrary line somewhere because of the particular difficulty with a negligent infliction of emotional distress cause of action, and here's where we draw the bright line. And what I'm saying is that if we open it up and eliminate the need for the proof of the intentional tort, and you can just bring anything as negligent infliction of emotional distress, then anything.
No, but if I understand you correctly, you're saying that you can prove the intentional tort, but if you don't bring a cause of action for the intentional tort, you can't recover for the negligent consequences of that intentional tort. No matter how much proof you put on that it was intentional, no matter how bad an actor you establish the defendant is, and no matter how much meanness and malicious intent was established to commit the act, that if there are negligent consequences, you cannot recover for them unless you sue for that malicious and intentional act.
That's right, Your Honor, because putting on proof isn't the same thing as convincing a jury of it. And one of the reasons this court, in various kinds of causes of action which are intentional torts, has put up a variety of specific requirements that must be met in order to prove that intentional tort is because they want to limit the availability of the recovery. And if you say, let's just put on the proof, but let's not go to the jury on whether or not indeed they met the proof and convinced the jury that the intentional act was committed, then it's been opened up to anything, including the hateful look or the locker room gossip that we talk about, leading to a jury trial. It's not in the extreme case such as this that the real harm is done. It is in the opening up of the courthouse to any claim for negligent infliction.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court, respondent will be represented by Mr. Ronald B. Chris.
Thank you. May it please the court. I was interested in the position of the appellee, that the appellant, that there has been a retreat from the various jurisdictions or by the various jurisdictions from this concept of negligent infliction of emotional distress. To the contrary, in August of this year, the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, in attempting to engraft or make a decision whether they should include or exclude the cause of action of emotional, negligent infliction of emotional distress in an FELA context, adopted. They did so after the Supreme Court of the United States invited them to look to the common law for guidance in whether or not this particular type of tort, pure emotional, should be, negligent inflicted emotional distress, should be part of the FELA. And the Fifth Circuit said there was no reluctance on its behalf to include negligent inflection of emotional distress as a compensable cause of action under the FELA. A far cry from a retreat from recognition of that type of cause of action. That is found, incidentally, it is mentioned in the amicus brief. It's Plaisance versus Texaco, 737 Federal 2nd, 1004. And it is really a very interesting case in as much as it set forth standards that will limit the ridiculous case. It set forth standards that the court said, you don't need to look to an arbitrary standard. You don't need to see whether or not there's physical injury. You don't need to look whether or not there's been a breach of a contract. The court recognized that the reason for all of those artificial barriers was because, number one, mental injuries are frequently transitory, temporary in nature, and clear up pretty quickly. Not so in our case, but that's one of the fears. Secondly, mental cases can be faked and feigned relatively easier than can a physical injury, and thus they look for some arbitrary rule. Was the distress so bad that they manifest itself physically? Or some other, where it was this person in the zone of danger if he wasn't himself injured? The Fifth Circuit said what we should do is we should look at it on the basis of whether or not a reasonable person, normally constituted, would have difficulty in dealing with the distress occasioned by the circumstances. In other words, leave it to the good common sense of the court as we do duty. And if someone comes in and says, he called me a yellow belt, I won't assume it. The court says, look, a reasonable person, normally constituted, is not going to not be able to deal with that type of distress. You're out of here.
That would be a jury determination, wouldn't it?
No, sir, that would be, in my view, a court determination to rid itself of the ridiculous case.
The court could screen the frivolous, what it deems to be frivolous from non-frivolous lawsuits?
I believe so, because the Fifth Circuit said we need to set up an objective standard with which we should deal with these cases. They said the alternative is very undesirable, because it would be the problems associated with the administration of the rule are great. Thus, let's let the innocent victim go unrecompensed to the benefit of the culprit. And they said, although it might be more difficult than this some arbitrary, reasonless standard, we need to employ it, because we recognize, they say, in adopting this cause of action as part of the FELA, that mental injuries can be every bit as much debilitating, every bit as painful, every bit as expensive as can physical injuries. We can't just close our eyes to the reality of that and say, because of the complexity in administering this objective test.
Petitioner has said that your client would be compensated on the basis of
other traditionally recognized causes of action, clearly recognized and they acknowledge under Texas law. Why should there be an additional cause of action for negligent infliction of emotional distress where persons, injured parties, can be recompensed under other traditionally recognized doctrines?
Because we couldn't. The intent to do an action is not the test. The test is whether or not that conduct was driven by an intent to injure, whether or not that conduct had as its primary purpose and not just its collateral purpose, an intent to do harm. The testimony in this case unequivocally was that these men did not intend to hurt her. The record is checkered with that testimony. More or less along the line of the old adage, what she doesn't know won't hurt.
Mr. Chris, you're saying that you could not recover in the right of privacy?
I'm saying that the right of privacy, the negligent infliction of privacy, has been held to be the law in this state by the Fifth Circuit in the Hustler versus Wood magazine case. However, in Blankenship, another Fifth Circuit case, Blankenship versus Kerr County, the Fifth Circuit interpreting St. Elizabeth versus Girard, not my interpretation, and not their interpretation, but the Fifth Circuit's interpretation is that it is clear an established independent cause of action, negligent infliction of emotional distress, as the Fifth Circuit's interpretation of St. Elizabeth versus Girard. Now, we could not prove without having a verdict directed against us that these men, it is a tougher standard of proof. It's not a lesser included offense, as they would suggest. They're mutually exclusive. If I intend to drive my car through a school zone at 120 miles an hour, I might not intend, although it's reasonably certain, that somebody might be killed. But it is the intent not of the doing of the act, but the intent to cause the harm that segregates an intentional tort from a negligent tort.
So you're saying you waived the intentional torts not so that you could get to the homeowner's policy, but because of the type of decisions you made with regards to proof,
the elements
of proof.
I'm telling Your Honor that we waived the intentional tort because we couldn't prove it, and we didn't want to clutter the charge with an allegation that we couldn't prove. But I'll say in all candor to you that I would have waived it if I thought not to do so would result in me getting a verdict that I couldn't collect. But that's not the case in this instance anyway, if you want to go beyond that record. These were not paupers that we were suing.
Counsel, where would racial, sexist, or ethnic remarks fall into this new cause of action?
Well, Your Honor, I would think that if a person, a reasonable person, normally constituted, could cope with whatever remark you have in mind adequately under the circumstances, that it would be excluded.
Isn't that a jury question?
I think, according to the Fifth Circuit, when they say it has to be matched against an objective standard, of course, if the evidence does not raise anything in light of that objective standard that the court feels would be compensable, I think that the court would have under that rationale, that objective standard, that new, as the Fifth Circuit called it, rubric. I think that that the court could dispel and dispense with these ridiculous type cases when they match those facts against the objective standard.
Counsel, on page 13 of your brief, you cite the Trevino case with respect to the standard. You've since cited the Fifth Circuit. I'm having trouble putting my, coming to a clear understanding of exactly how the standard would work.
I think the standard would simply work as follows. I think, for example, let's take the case at bar. Let's take the case at bar, Your Honor, and see how the standard would work there. In the case at bar, we have a girl who the testimony has indicated was, and I think this is all important in determining how this standard would work. The testimony indicated was an elected cheerleader, an elected homecoming princess to the court. Sister Jane Meyer of St. Agnes Academy said she was a wonderful person, a moral person, and one of their outstanding students. She is surreptitiously, covertly videotaped in the act of giving up herself in intercourse. She then learned some months later that this is distributed according to the confessions of the defendant to at least 10 people, but with rumors as far-flung as universities and other states. Now, would a woman, a reasonable woman, of normal, constituted normal, would such a woman be able to adequately cope with the anguish engendered by that type of conduct and treatment of her? My answer to that is that this is the most visceral insult a woman can ever sustain.
Mr. Chris, this is a gross case.
Yes, and therefore,
whatever we write will not only impact this case, but it will impact the example, for example, of the case in Hawaii that was mentioned about the dog that died or was killed and the owner sued for negligent infliction of emotional distress because of the dog. How would that type of case fit in with your standards that you're trying to get us to adopt?
Very well, Your Honor, and I to answer both of your questions hopefully at once, I would go into that as my next example. I think that you could say, look, a person, a reasonable person normally constituted, will be able to cope with the death of this dog.
Is that a jury question or a judge question?
When the Fifth Circuit used the words should be matched against as their new rubric, an objective standard, I think that you're going to have some judicial interplay there. I think that you're going to have to say in an obviously insignificant, trivial case, you're going to have to simply say, matching this conduct against this objective standard, we find that this does not constitute a cause of action, that a reasonable person normally constituted should be able to cope with this. As Dean Keaton used to tell me in our tarts class, everyone has to have a certain measure of social toughness. And I think that's what that rubric really says.
So you agree there has to be some limitation on recovery of damages for this tort?
I agree, Your Honor, that under the current state of Texas law, it probably is open-ended. And if it makes...
The limitation you would advocate would be a judge screened, a judge screening at the before the case goes to the jury to avoid jury trials on loss of a dog or some other piece of...
I think the Fifth Circuit has fashioned a very, very workable rubric that satisfies all critics, and I think the Fifth Circuit was right in saying, what's the alternative? I let the wrongdoer go free at the expense of the innocent victim because we have some complexity in implementing the standard, or because perhaps some trivial lawsuits will be filed, we should just say, well, to heck with the entire body of that measure of the tort law, contrary in this instance, to establish Texas law.
Would there be some limitation on recovery for this tort based upon First Amendment considerations in the event of ethnic racial slurs such that Judge Cook mentioned a moment ago?
Well, Your Honor, I have not thought of that aspect of this case. I certainly haven't thought of whether or not it would become interfered with by First Amendment rights. I do think that that I mean I don't see where that would be an issue. I haven't looked into that aspect.
Mr. Chris, you were asked earlier whether or not something about urging a new tort. Are you urging a new tort here, or are you simply re-urging a tort action recognized in this state over a century ago?
I am re-urging the same tort that was established in Hill versus Kimball, reaffirmed 10 years later in 1900 by the Hayter opinion, and reaffirmed in 1985 by St. Elizabeth, reaffirmed by the Fifth Circuit following St. Elizabeth and Blankenship County, once again relied upon heavily in Plaisance by the Fifth Circuit with reference to their FELA efforts. And incidentally, Hill versus Kimball, it was mentioned earlier that today that case would not be a winnable case in Texas because it was a bystander case. In the case of Harmon versus Flowers Transportation Company, the Fifth Circuit once again said, we are aware of no case in Texas where a person who witnessed an accident and was not injured and the victim in the accident was not related to the individual, can collect or has a cause of action unless that person is in fear of bodily harm themselves. That was the case in Hill versus Kimball. You had a pregnant woman who I think you could successfully argue was in fear of her own safety and that of her baby. And I think that's why Harmon versus Flowers Transportation took the position that that was the one exception to the third-party witness rule, bystander, if you will, where there's still, there can still be, because it was a seminal case, where there can still be recovery absent contemporaneous sensory perception involving a close family relative. Hill versus Campbell was a relative, but I think that Harmon recognized that woman was in fear of herself or zone of danger, if you will.
Mr. Chris, you are aware that Section 46 of the restatement permits recovery where there's reckless conduct, where there's extreme and outrageous conduct, and it was caused recklessly. Are there findings in this case, except, of course, the archaic requirement disapproved by this court of physical manifestation, which that section also embodies, but accepting that, do you have findings in this case that would support recovery under Restatement Section 46?
Gross negligence findings, Your Honor.
And do you, you contend that that suffices for reckless?
I do.
What do you have concerning extreme and outrageous conduct?
Well, Your Honor, what you have is you have a case where you have a young girl who was giving of herself in sexual encounters. Her relationship was described as infatuation masked as love. She made an error that many, many, many millions of women have made before. They always seem to fall in love with the wrong people. She did. And that act of love was met with cynicism, was met with duplicitousness, and was met with betrayal. That's outrageous to take a woman who, incidentally, this was her first serious sexual partner, the record reveals. This was her fourth act of intercourse, always with the same boy in her life, and to have that giving of herself met with such a callous disregard and indifference to her well-being, I think speaks for itself. But there is a difference between these people being driven to do this by their own mischievous voyeurism, by their own and by a desire to injure her. I really don't think, I think they were more or less nonplussed by it and indifferent to whether it really did or didn't, but I really don't think that their conduct was driven by an intent to injure. Thus, with all of them denying it, and with their lawyers arguing throughout the trial, this was but a moment of carelessness, a moment of indifference, just a moment. I didn't think, notwithstanding the resources of the defendant, that I better tamper with intentional tort. I had a right to take the tort I thought I clearly established. I had a right to select negligent infliction of emotional distress because it was so well established in this state without any question. And every appellate court that's ever read St. Elizabeth Hospital versus Girard has always held consistently it stood for a separate, independent, unfettered cause of action in Texas. Six appellate courts, Court of Civil Appeals, Intermediate Courts, Fifth Circuit, all of them have repeatedly said it. And I had a right to rely on it. Separate independent tort means it does not have to be collateral to some other trespass or some other sort of tort.
Mr. Chris, let me ask you a little bit about the intentional tort that you did not pursue to this court. The petitioner says that the act giving rise to that is intending to do an act, and the consequences do not have to be foreseen. You said a few minutes ago that indeed you have to foresee that harm will result. What is your best case on that?
The petitioner's dead wrong about it, Your Honor, is my position, and that is that the restatement of tort Section 8 of the Restatement of Tort says the word intent is used throughout the restatement of this subject to denote that the actor desires to cause consequences of his act. or that he believes that the consequences are substantially certain to result from it. Not that he intended to do the act, but that he intended the consequences. And it is similar, for example, let me tell you the kind of case that should be rejected because it was tried on an intentional basis and submitted on a negligence basis. And that's the case that involved, by way of interest, a former plaintiff's attorney, Vernice Fulmer, from Nacogdoches, Texas. Vernice was killed, and there was a lawsuit brought by his heirs claiming that he was negligently shot, and and the court rejected that in Fulmer versus Ryder and said, no, that's not so. I said, you knew when you aim a gun at someone and shoot them that you're intending to kill them. You're intending the consequences of that act to seriously injure them or kill them. And it wasn't done negligently. And you cannot, therefore, place this round peg in this square hole. But that's the sort of thing where the intent or the consequences of the act are substantially certain to follow. The example given in the restatement is if you open up the door to an office and you throw a bomb in it and you hope to kill one occupant of the office but not the other, although that was your intent and both occupants were killed, it was substantially certain that the second occupant would be killed as well as the first, dynamite being non-discriminatory, and thus you have committed an intentional tort as to both.
So if you set up a videotape recorder and do exactly what was done in this case, isn't it substantially certain that the young lady is going to be upset about it?
Only if she knows. And the testimony was universal throughout. There was never one word, Your Honor, to the contrary, that what she doesn't know wouldn't hurt her. We didn't intend to hurt her. We didn't have any consideration for her feelings on the matter, but we did not intend to hurt her. We hoped for and thought surely she would never find out about it. Others even thought that it would be destroyed immediately after it was viewed, and they were negligent in not doing so.
Well, how is that any different from throwing a bomb in a room and hoping that nobody's in there except the person that you want to kill?
Because this is a psychic part, and if you don't learn about something of this nature, it won't hurt you. And the bomb in the room was a physical tort, and you were going to blow both of them up.
Well, not if you're hoping with all your heart that there's only one person in there. And just by momentary carelessness, there happened to be two.
Well, if you didn't know that there was another one in there, I believe that you would not be guilty of an intentional tort. But the distinguishing characteristic, Your Honor, from all of the rights, and all of the restatements, and all of the cases, has to do with the focusing upon the intent, not of the act, but the intent of the consequences. If you're driven by, primarily driven to do whatever you do, to hurt, to harm, if that's the principal driving influence and force, then you're guilty of an intentional act. But short of that subjective intent, if you just intend to do something, and it has injurious consequences, no matter how reckless, no matter even if you're indifferent, as it's said in the gross negligence statute, even if you're indifferent to the consequences, or have a callous disregard for the consequences, unless you intend those consequences, you're not liable for an intentional tort.
I always thought the law was to the contrary, that you took your plaintiff as you found him, and if you intended a battery, the fact that he... remember from law school, the fact that he had an eggshell skull was just no excuse. If you mean to do the offensive touching, then you're responsible for whatever consequences ensue, even though you would have said, well, yes, but I thought the way he acted, he was so bullheaded, I figured that if I hit him, it wouldn't hurt that much.
Once you undertake a course of conduct where you intend to do harm, if the magnitude of that harm exceeds what you had hoped for, you're still guilty of an intentional tort. You simply hurt him worse than you intended to, but you still hurt him. Even in this context, there is a case where a truck driver sues for negligent infliction of emotional distress because he'd been in another wreck where he killed three people. And in this case, he uh, he was fearful that he had killed this woman. And they rejected his claim, Texas courts did, saying that, that the foreseeability aspect was not there. This lady who he had the wreck with had no way of anticipating that he had come into this thing with such a fragile mentality that this would cause him problems. Incidentally, that would be, you see, that very text the rubric that the Fifth Circuit has come up with would exclude that case as well, not on foreseeability grounds, but upon the objective test of a reasonable person, normally constituted, would not have been offended. And incidentally, in the Poisson's case itself, the one that engrafted this is what tells me that it really is a judge-made thing. They said, incidentally, Mr. Poisson, although you gave us the factual background upon which we have created this rubric, you don't qualify. Because a reasonably prudent tugboat operator with normally constituted would not have been unable to cope with the mental distress occasioned by seeing a burning barge. And so actually, in Poisson's, the court, as a matter of law, rejected that claim.
If, in this case, there were no camera, but the male involved instead sat down and wrote a letter to a fraternity brother and mailed the letter to the fraternity brother describing the events, and the fraternity brother then circulated the letter in the fraternity house, would we have the same situation? He intended to write the letter, but he didn't intend the circulation.
I think that there's a vast difference in that fact situation, because in this instance you have made someone an unwitting pornographic queen, and that's what she was known as. And in the letter situation you have a mere braggadociousness, which many college boys are prone to. But I think there's a far cry between actually videotaping a woman in the act of intercourse, making her an unwitting participant in lewd activity, and someone writing a letter saying, I've seduced Jenny.
I understand that. I was just trying to set parameters.
I think we'd have to look at the circumstances, as the Fifth Circuit suggests, and just said, well, Jane, if a person, a reasonable person, normally constituted under all the circumstances, would you be able to live with the mental distress occasioned by this act? I really think, Judge, that we're going to have to, Justice Cook, we're going to have to look at all the circumstances to make that determination. But I think that that would be the low end of the scale compared to this. I'll admit, Judge, this is an outrageous case. It doesn't get any worse than this. You know, to suggest that this woman is entitled to no remedy because she falls within that gray twilight that they didn't intend to hurt her, and they would say there is no negligent infliction of emotional distress, so she's just remediless. I think if there's no remedy in this case, for goodness sakes, and what sort of case is there a remedy? Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you. There are a number of things I'd like to get to. First of all, Mr. Chris has changed his position from the Court of Appeals, where he was asked a question. There were facts in this case that showed that the day after the first sexual encounter, Ms. Kerr went and told a friend about it and was asked by the court, well, would that have given a rise to a cause of action for negligent infliction of emotional distress? After a pause, Mr. Chris said, yes, it would. That's the kind of braggadocio. He now says, well, maybe it would. Problem is, there's no clear line. Talked about the matter of this dog case and how this Fifth Circuit case would cut that off. In the dog case in Hawaii, in fact, it did make it to a jury. They did put on a battle with psychiatrists, and the jury did award damages in that case, and it was upheld by the Court of Appeals because these people were greatly distressed by the loss of their dog. On Section 46, I've been thinking about the questions I got on that. Section 46 of the restatement goes to intentional infliction of emotional distress. That's the cause of action which is recognized in Texas. Next, Fleissing's, the Texaco case, which was referred to as the Fifth Circuit case. Important aspect of that.
Before we leave Section 46, it does permit recovery for reckless conduct, doesn't it?
Yes. Yes, Your Honor. And as I understand Section 46, it is an adoption by the restatement or recommendation by the restatement of an intentional infliction of emotional distress cause of action, which is permitted in the state.
And are you saying we should not have a cause of action for reckless conduct?
There should not be an independent tort for, if you're asking me if there should be an independent tort for reckless infliction of emotional distress
right.
as opposed to negligent infliction of emotional distress.
What's the substantive difference?
Well, let me get my answer first, because I think you are saying that.
Yes, I think that short of the meeting the standard of intentional infliction of emotional distress, that there should not be a tort in the state.
So if the restatement of torts provides for recovery for reckless infliction of emotional distress, you disagree and don't want us to adopt that part of the restatement?
That's correct. To the extent that if the restatement does suggest a tort short of intentional infliction of emotional distress, is our position that it engenders many of the same kinds of problems that a negligent infliction tort would cause.
And then the question I interrupted, what is the difference between reckless disregard for another and gross negligence?
Well,
it
wouldn't have been as forgiving if I had interrupted. It's always a matter of degree. And in terms of the statement of the standard for intentional infliction, to the extent that reckless intention drops from that standard, it then moves towards the negligent infliction. Obviously, from our point of view, the more stringent the requirements on the emotional distress tort, however it's phrased, the more protection there is. The facts in this case are, though, that it was not the jury posed, the question posed to the jury was not one of, was there reckless infliction of emotional distress? It was there negligent interference with her mental well-being?
If your client truly intended with all their heart that the plaintiff never find out about their acts, and they took great precautions to swear everyone in their confederacy to secrecy, is there no intent under Texas law?
There is no intent, and the reason is that this, Mr. Chris correctly read the restatement of torts in terms of the words, but when the restatement of torts talks about intending the consequences of the act, it is not the harm which must be intended, it is the act. In this case, the building of the Atchison case, for example, what you must intend to do is invade privacy. In this case, what you might have intended to do was to invade her privacy by videotaping.
Well, now, I'm not talking about intentional invasion of privacy right now, but intentional infliction of emotional distress. If your intention is that this person never find out and therefore never have any distress, is there in fact no intentional tort?
As I understand the tort, if a jury ultimately finds, in this case or some other, or were to find that there was no intention to inflict the emotional distress, which in that case is the harm as opposed to the invasion of privacy, then as I understand the tort of intentional infliction of emotional distress, there is no violation.
So in fact, if Mr. Chris' recitation of the fact is correct, he would not have been able to prevail on that tort.
But he would have been able to prevail on the intentional invasion of privacy and would still have been able to recover the mental anguish damages that he seeks as an element of damages for that tort.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument in the second clause. The court will now take another brief recess.
The audience, please rise.